very good afternoon, brothers and sisters, young people, and respected friends. We extend a very cordial welcome to you all, and thank you for coming so from such a distance. So our subject for consideration this evening is Holy War for Jerusalem. So, to introduce our remarks, we'd like to read from Zechariah 13. There's many chapters we could read from, but I think this one is pertinent. Zechariah 13, chapter 13. In that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. And it shall come to pass in that day, says Yahweh, says the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they shall be no more remembered. Also I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land. And it shall come to pass that when any shall yet prophesy, then his father and his mother that begat him shall say unto him, Thou shalt not live, for thou speakest lies in the name of the Lord. And his father and his mother that begat him shall thrust him through when he prophesieth. And it shall come to pass in that day that the prophet shall be ashamed, every one in his vision, when he hath prophesied. Neither shall they wear a rough garment to deceive, but he shall say, I am no prophet, I am a husbandman. For man taught me to keep cattle from my youth. And one shall say unto him, What are these wounds in thine hand? Then he shall answer, Those which I was wounded in the house of my friends. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, It is my people, and they shall say, The Lord is my God, or Yahweh is my Elohim. And I'd just like to add these words, which are quoted by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, in his speech to the United Nations last week. I have set watchmen upon the walls, thy walls, O Jerusalem, who shall never hold their peace, day nor night. Ye that make mention of the Lord, keep not silent, and give him no rest till he establish, until he make Jerusalem a praise in the earth. That's taken from Isaiah 62, verse 6 and 7. I thought those were very apt words spoken by the Prime Minister of Israel. Well, without further ado, we shall commence our remarks upon this exciting subject, Holy War for Jerusalem. Now, it would be a mistake to think that Jerusalem is any city, like any other city, like, say, New York, or Paris, or London, or Sydney, or Tokyo. It isn't. This city is a completely different city, and is a very special city, unlike any other city on the face of the earth. When all these cities are thrown down, Jerusalem will be glorious, and will prosper. And we see a picture of that, a future status of Jerusalem in Psalm 48. Just to start our subject on a positive note, there is a divine endpoint to the city of Jerusalem. As Bible students, we regard world events as not mere happen chance. They are not mere happenstance. God is in control of major world events and is bringing all things to the fruition of his purpose. God rules in the kingdoms of men. And we have in the scriptures the sure word of prophecy, as the Apostle Peter points out. The sure word of prophecy. So we can rely on the prophetic word that we read in the scriptures, that are the very oracles of God. It says, though God spake himself when he speaks through the prophets or through the apostles or the Lord Jesus Christ, but though God spake himself. So we read in Psalm 48, great is the Lord, great is Yahweh, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God. Now this city of our God, or the city of Elohim, is Jerusalem, in the mountain of his holiness. So the psalmist, and this is a psalm for the sons of Korah, as the superscription indicates, this is a priestly class in Israel. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, on the side of the north, the city of the great king. So here's your citadel of Zion, which is described as the joy of the whole earth. Now you could look back all the way through several thousand years concerning Jerusalem, and you would not find it the joy of the whole earth. Under David and Solomon, Jerusalem was indeed brought to a pinnacle of its glory under ancient Israel, in the reign, and particularly in the reign of Solomon. And if we were to turn to 1 Chronicles 29, chapter 29, we would find that Solomon actually sat on the throne of the Lord. So this throne of the Lord, which he inherited from David, was indeed the throne of God himself. That David sat upon the throne, and Solomon inherited that throne. Verse 23. Then Solomon sat on the throne of the Lord, or of Yahweh, as king, instead of David, his father, and prospered, and all Israel obeyed him. So the throne of David, which was promised to Christ in Luke chapter 1, is not in Transkyane, it is not in heaven. The throne of David was categorically in the holy city of Jerusalem. Now when we talk about holy war, we call it holy war because it's a religious dimension, and more specifically because it is appertaining to the holy land of Israel, or the holy city of Jerusalem. And the Palestine Exploration Fund actually detailed 27 sieges that have been made against Jerusalem and conflicts over the city of Jerusalem. 27. And if we add recent ones, the War of Independence, the Suez Crisis, the 1967 June War, and the Yom Kippur War. It was Yom Kippur yesterday, if I'm sure most of you knew that are sitting here. The War of the Day of Atonement, that was in 1973, and wars against Lebanon, and the final conflict, which is described in the scriptures as Armageddon, this final conflict over Jerusalem, that we can make it 33 conflicts over Jerusalem. Now that is a very significant number, because Christ was 33 when he was crucified and put to death and was raised up 3 days later. So 33 is a very significant number in relation to the purpose of God with his people, with the city of Jerusalem, and with his son, the Lord Jesus Christ. Because as Acts chapter 1 describes, why stand ye gazing up into Jerusalem? For this same Jesus which ye have seen go into heaven shall so come in like manner as ye have seen him go. So the Lord's ascension was not an end of the matter, as the churches think. Christ is ordained to return to the earth, this time as a conqueror, and to subdue his enemies. And that is clearly foretold in Psalm 110, verse 1. The Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. So Christ is at the right hand of God, according to Scripture, until he returns to make his enemies his footstool. In other words, he destroys them that are opposed to the Scriptures, that are opposed to his people Israel, and that are opposed to the things of Christ. He will destroy them. Let us make no hesitation about saying this statement. So we would like to consider more thoroughly this aspect of this holy war against Jerusalem. The very name of Jerusalem means a vision of peace. A vision of peace. Now peace has eluded the nations all the way through, we could say, since Noah. He's striven for peace, and we've got the United Nations today, but it would be better termed the disunited nations, who strive to make a one world system of the nations, but they have miserably failed. The more man strives to bring peace, the more there is international conflict over the, and particularly over the Holy Land and Jerusalem and the holy places. When we think of holy war against Jerusalem, we probably think of the Crusades. And there is no question, these were wars to regain Jerusalem from the Muslims that had invaded that land and set up the Dome of the Rock in the year 685. In Daniel chapter 9, this is called the abomination that maketh desolation. So the Muslims have a claim to that land, as does the Catholic Church with its holy places of Christendom and the Holy Sepulchre. Wars have been fought over the Holy Sepulchre. The Crimean War was over the disputation as who should control the keys of the Holy Sepulchre and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Daniel chapter 9 and verse 27. He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause a sacrifice and oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So what this verse is telling us is that the sacrifices in Jerusalem would be taken away. And they were taken away by the Roman power. When they crucified and cut off the Messiah, verse 26, the people of the prince would come and destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. So the Roman power, which was the people of the prince, the word prince is Nagid, a king expectant, and Daniel says he would be cut off. He did not come in his first advent as Melech, the king of Israel. He came as the Nagid, the prince expectant. So he was crucified as the prince expectant. They rejected him, the Jews, the hierarchy of the Jews, as their Messiah, because they did not expect to see a suffering servant. They expected to see Messiah, King of Israel, who would overthrow and destroy the enemy, particularly the Roman occupier of Palestine, and establish the kingdom of God. This is what they looked for. So when Christ manifested himself in the weakness of sin's flesh, although he overcame sin's flesh, he was a mortal like us, sin's flesh, and he crucified, he was obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. The sinless, suffering Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world. So they did not expect to see such a Christ, which means the Anointed One or Messiah. They expected to see the Melech, Israel, King of Israel, a powerful conqueror and oriental potentate. So what we have here is that he would be cut off, but in recompense, Christ himself would bring the Roman power, the people of the prince, and this is also found in the parables of Messiah, in, for example, Matthew 21, the parable of the vineyard, that God sent his servants to the husbandman who looked after the vineyard, Yahweh's vineyard, God's vineyard. The husbandmen were the hierarchy, the Jewish hierarchy. They were the priests. They were the high priest. They were Caiaphas and his father. They were the Pharisees. They were the Sadducees. They were the lawyers. These were the stewards or the husbandmen of Yahweh's vineyard, of God's vineyard. Now what did they do and their predecessors when God sent his servants, the prophets? They rejected them. They would not hear the message nor the messenger. They were despised and rejected. You know that Jeremiah was placed in the stocks, one of God's faithful prophets, warning them of their apostasy, warning them about the coming judgments. But they would not listen, they would not hear. They put him in the stocks, and then they threw him into a horrible pit. And he was up to neck, in his neck in the mire. And he would have perished, and that was the idea. Like Joseph was thrown into the horrible pit. He was despised and rejected of his brethren, and thrown into the horrible pit, and with the intention that he die. And that was the intention of those that took Jeremiah, that he died. And therefore, typically, he did die. But God brought him out, as we know the story of Ebed-Melech, who took clouts and tied them together and pulled with 30 men Jeremiah out of that pit. So, this overspreading of the abomination, this is in the 70-week prophecy, which commences verse 24, is this Muslim power. The Jewish economy came to its end in AD 70, when Titus and Vespasian, the people of the prince, came against that city. There is a picture of the Dome of the Rock, a well-known picture of the dome on the Temple Mount, which still stands to this day. So, if we have a look at Matthew 23, we want to go back to trace some of the historical conflicts with the city of Jerusalem. Matthew 23, we find there that the Lord, he wept over Jerusalem. And you find similar words when he came to Jerusalem in Luke 19, but let's have a look at Matthew 23. So, after his servants were sent, God said, "Surely I will send my son and they will reverence him." But they didn't. They killed him. So what shall be done to those people? Well, the Pharisees answered themselves, turning back to Matthew 21, verse 41, they say unto him, "They will miserably destroy those wicked men." This is the Pharisees themselves saying this. They're condemning themselves, but they don't realise it. "He will miserably destroy those wicked men, and will let out his vineyard unto other husbandmen, which shall render him the fruits in their season." And Jesus said unto them, "Did ye never read in the scriptures, 'The stone which the builders rejected, that was himself, shall become the head of the corner'?" This is a citation from Psalm 118. This is the Lord's doing, and he's marvellous in our eyes. So although they rejected and crucified Christ, he will yet be Melech Israel, and he will become the head of the corner of that new Jerusalem, that new temple that Christ will establish at his apocalypse. So we have there in Matthew 23, "Verily I say unto you, all ye you, all these things shall come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets, and stonest them which are sent unto thee. How often, how would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathered her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. So Christ desired that the people listen to him, and that they hear his word, and that he could have saved them then. Behold, because they rejected him, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth, till you say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Now, as there was an end of Jewish times in AD 70, and more than a million people perished in Jerusalem, Cestius Gallus had backed away from the city, allowing people to escape. They remembered the Olivet prophecy. He said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded with armies, that's in the next chapter, Matthew 24, he said, flee. And they fled to Pella, Josephus records, to escape just in time before Titus, with 60,000 soldiers, closed in on Jerusalem, making it impossible to escape. And what happened then? He besieged the city, and then he burst through the outer wall, and then the inner wall, and then finally into the Temple Mount. It is known that he wanted to save the city, did Titus. We've got a picture here of the Roman attack on Jerusalem. So you probably won't be able to see that here, but they attacked near the Jaffa Gate. If any of you have been to Jerusalem, the Jaffa Gate is on the west side. The road leads down to Jaffa, or Joppa, and the citadel is there, just by the Jaffa Gate. Well, the Romans burst through that wall, and then they came into the upper city, and then into the Temple Mount. So they breached all these three or four walls that surrounded the holy city. And over a million perished. A million is recorded, and the rest were taken into captivity. And the evangelist Luke, he says, Jerusalem shall be downtrodden until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled, and they should be led away into captivity in all nations of the earth. And anyone who knows the history of the Jews knows that there's barely a single nation where the Jews are not found or have been there. It can even be distant China. It can be all parts of Europe and Russia and Poland. And we know about the Holocaust in the war, how Hitler exterminated 6 million of the Jews. There's been every attempt to destroy the Jews, but they've all failed. Where are the ancient Babylonians? Where are the Assyrians? Where are the Philistines? Where are the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Edomites? No, they don't exist. They've ceased to exist. But every attempt has been made to destroy Jewry, but they've all failed. Now why? Because God is protecting that people and preserving them for a purpose. Isaiah 43 says the Jews are my witnesses. If we want a witness that God is controlling world events, it is the Jews. And there's only one place you can go to find out the origin of the Jews, and that is in the scriptures, in the book of Exodus, when Moses brought them out of captivity in Egypt, through the Red Sea, down to Sinai to receive the law. And the waters were snap frozen on either side of the children of Israel as they went through the Red Sea with Pharaoh in hot pursuit after him. And then God allowed, when they were all safely on the far shore, the waters to come cascading down and destroy Pharaoh and his armies. And this is a foretaste of what is coming upon the earth. And the armies of the world will be destroyed. They will be destroyed on the mountains of Israel. This is the place where God has chosen to destroy his enemies, on the mountains of Israel. Now, if we look at 1 Chronicles 6, we'll see why Jerusalem is such a special city. because God has chosen to place his name there. Sorry. 1 Kings. Let's try 1 Kings, please. It is in the Chronicles. But I want to turn to 1 Kings chapter 6. Right, chapter 8. That thy eyes, verse 29, may be open toward this house, night and day, even toward the place of which thou hast said, my name shall be there. So this was the city where God had chosen to place his name. And verse 11, for the glory of the Lord hath filled the house of the Lord. This was the temple of Solomon. So Jerusalem and the temple that Solomon built was the place where God had chosen to place his name there. This word Makkos. In the parallel chapter in Chronicles, if we go back to Chronicles, we find that word Makkos, the place, is mentioned at least half a dozen or seven times. Chapter 6, 2 Chronicles, chapter 6. Verse 6, but I have chosen Jerusalem that my name might be there. And the name is mentioned seven times, the house for my name. Verse 10, the house for the name of the Lord God of Israel. This place, verse 20, the place thou hast said that would put us thy name there. Now God's name, what is his name? This is the city that God has chosen to place his name, the city of Jerusalem. No other city on the face of the earth. And David and Solomon, to a degree, established the name of Yahweh. When David, he first took up the head of Goliath, when he'd slain that Goliath of the Philistines, he took the head up to Jerusalem, didn't he? And we find that very place, the place of the skull, this is where they think it was so called because of Goliath's head was buried there by David. That very place, Christ was crucified. He overcame the Goliath of the flesh, the Goliath of sin's flesh, in the place called Calvary. If you look up Luke 23, you'll see he was crucified in Calvary. And the word Calvary means a place of the skull, or a skull. And of course this goes through, this giant of the flesh was slain. This is the cause of all the wickedness and evil in the world, what is called human nature. Christ slew it. He condemned sin in the flesh, Romans 8 verse 3. And the final conflict will be the crushing of that desolator, that destroyer of his people, on the mountains of Israel, that great Goliath Colossus that we see in Daniel chapter 2, and we'll have a look at that in a few moments. But coming back to the name, this name of Yahweh, as we say, the name of Yahweh is his character, goodness, abundant in goodness and mercy and long-suffering, but will by no means clear the guilty. So there's two sides to God's character. Yes, he is merciful and just, but also he will destroy those that are guilty. Those who have rejected him, or who have compromised, who have been faithless, or have blasphemed his holy name, that's pretty well most of the earth. So this name, when we saw those words in Psalm 48, when we turn to Zechariah, we see that name there. planted upon the mountains of Israel. And to Zechariah, there's so many references in Zechariah to the future of Jerusalem, as you probably know. Zechariah was one of the prophets of the Restoration. When they returned from Babylon under Ezra and Zerubbabel. So there's many, many prophecies in the visions that Zechariah had concerning the future of Jerusalem. They, in fact, did establish the Second Temple and a kind of New Jerusalem. But it wasn't the Third Temple, it wasn't the Jerusalem. So, for example, we'll just skip through a few of these chapters. The verse 2 of Zechariah 2. He said unto me, measure Jerusalem. So this measuring, this correction of Jerusalem would go on for almost 2,000 years. In verse 14 of chapter 1, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great joy, and a line shall be stretched upon Jerusalem, verse 16. And his sword is pleased, verse 15, with the heathen that are at ease. For I was put a little displeased, and they hope for the affliction. So this is a reference to the Gentiles' attitude towards the Jews and towards Israel. They see it as no different from any other nation. This is their big mistake. This was this mistake that all Israel's enemies made, that it was no different from any other nation. But it was the apple of God's eye. They make a big mistake in thinking that Jerusalem and Israel are just ordinary nations like any other nation. This is their mistake. This is the city which God has chosen to place his name there. And we read in verse 8 of Zechariah 2 that he that touches you touches the apple of his eye. So those that burden themselves with Jerusalem, and Zechariah goes on to speak of Jerusalem being a burdensome stone and a cup of trembling to all nations. And indeed, when they gather their armies around to destroy the Jews and destroy Jerusalem, it will be indeed a cup of trembling to them as they will taste the wrath of Yahweh's anger. Woe and calamity are coming upon this earth. We can see it in every direction now, particularly in the Middle East and the greater Middle East. At this present time, we've got ISIS. They're making holy war for Jerusalem. The Islamic Caliphate. You've got Hamas. They're deadly enemies of Israel. They want to make war and take Jerusalem and wipe out the Jews. We've got an article here. Syria vows to respond if attacked and warns of World War III. So we know there's lots of trouble in Syria. EU threatens over construction sites in Jerusalem. They plan to build 2,610 homes. Now this is a cause of much resentment in the EU countries, in Europe, because it undermines their bid for world peace and the two-state solution. Netanyahu, in his speech to the UN, Iran is a bigger threat than the Islamic State. And if we look in Ezekiel 38, we'll see that Iran is with the Prince of Rosh at the time of the end. Senate okays US-Israel strategic partnership bill. So US, the United States of America, has cemented its strategic partnership with Israel for the coming crisis, the coming world conflict centred on Jerusalem. Hamas officials, this was taken off Arat Sheva, the Israel National News, today, will expel or kill all the Zionists. But what does verse 12 say, Zechariah 2? Yahweh shall inherit Judah, his portion, in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. Be silent, O all flesh, before the Lord, for he is raised up out of his holy habitation. What beautiful verses to keep in remembrance, respected friends, brethren and sisters and young people. And Yahweh shall inherit Judah, his portion, that is, in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. And then will all flesh be silent. If we turn over to Zechariah 6, we have the picture there of the chariots coming between the two mountains of brass in verse 1. And these the horses that pull these chariots, like unto the cherubim, are red, black, white, and grizzled. They represent different campaigns of Christ and the saints moving through these two mountains of brass to deliver his people and save the city of Jerusalem. Of course, Jerusalem will be an entirely different city at the new Jerusalem under Christ and the saints. But here they are going forth, the four spirits of the heavens, going forth to the north, to the south, verse 6 and so forth, until we have the situation in verse 12. The man whose name is the branch, he shall grow up out of his place. He shall build the temple of the Lord. Even he shall build the temple of Yahweh, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne. And he shall be a priest upon the throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. So here is the future glory of Jerusalem under Christ, the man whose name is the Branch, who sprang forth from the tomb, and now liveth for evermore. He will build the third temple. He will be a king priest in Jerusalem. Notice that. He is both a priest. And upon his throne, he is a king priest. He is a Melchizedek priest. And in Zechariah 8, we see there a future picture of Jerusalem. Verse 3, thus I was zealous for Zion, verse 2. Thus saith the Lord, I am returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem shall be a city of truth. Now, anything but a city of truth now is Jerusalem. Is every conceivable heresy and lie resident in the city of Jerusalem, and abomination, and not at least secularism. Secularism is the great enemy of God and of the truth. Even the Haredi Jews, the Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem, they fight to keep separate from the goyim, from the secular influence of the world. It is anathema to them because they know it will corrode and corrupt their values. When a disciple of Christ goes amongst the world, he is going amongst the Canaanites, who will corrupt him if he is not exceedingly careful to keep separate. And so we can take a lesson out of the Hasidic Jews or the Haredi, who were always the women folk modestly attired, never copying the Gentiles. So we have there in verse 3, thus saith the Lord, I am returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. And we have that beautiful picture in verse 5, the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof. Thus saith the Lord of hope, Yahweh of hosts, if it be marvellous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in those days, should it also be marvellous in mine eyes. Behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country. They shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. They shall be my people, and I will be their God, in truth and in righteousness. Now they're going to have to fight at the end of Gentile times, which is now, just as there was an end of Jewish times, so there is an end of Gentile times. And we are living in that epoch. All the signs clearly indicate this is the end of Gentile times. So they will have to fight, and Zechariah shows us this in the remaining chapters. Chapter 9. Verse 12. Turn ye to the stronghold, ye prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee. For now I bent Judah for me, and filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greek. So here is Ephraim, the diaspora Jews, and Judah, he will save the tents of Judah first. Verse 7 of chapter 12, The Lord also shall save the tents of Judah first. So the Jews back in that land are primarily Judah. And they will be saved first by Christ moving up from Sinai. Isaiah 63, who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garment, traveling in the greatness of his strength? It is I, Yahweh, mighty to save. Eloah cometh from Teman. Habakkuk 3. So he moves up to Jerusalem to liberate it from the occupier. Now we believe, and the scriptures clearly indicate, is that the occupier of Jerusalem will be Russia, who will come sweep down from Turkey, will take Constantinople first, and re-establish the empire of Justinian and Constantine, whom the city is named, Constantinople. He will unite East and Western Christendom with the aid of the papacy and the Germanic beast. We might think of the last war and think, was that a holy war? Well, indeed it was, because Rommel tried to come through North Africa and was within inches of taking Cairo, and the other pincer was to come down through the Caucasus until Hitler got distracted with Stalingrad and had to divert his forces to Stalingrad, much against his generals' advice, because they wanted to take Jerusalem, take the Middle East, take the Holy Land, and the Mufti of Jerusalem was collaborating with the Nazis to bring about this. The Mufti of Jerusalem, who of course was an Islamic emir, and they very nearly pulled this off. But God raised up the men to defend the city of Jerusalem. The 8th Army, the British 8th Army, and under General Montgomery, they drove back the Nazi Third Reich forces away from the Holy Land and away from Egypt, back into Tunisia, and then right back up the bootleg of Italy, and finally opened the second front, the Atlantic Wall, and destroyed the Germanic beast. So God used these Tarshish forces, the British and American forces, and the Commonwealth forces, to destroy the beast. So this was indeed a holy war, and the First World War was similar, because the much of it centred around the Holy Land. Many don't appreciate this, but the First World War was not so much about a static front along across Europe and the trenches. This was the beast again that had risen up, and the Tarshish forces were holding it so it wouldn't take the United Kingdom, with its navy and with its military, holding that line for 4 years in desperate carnage and slaughter along that line of the trenches. And they tried to take, the Turks had come out on the German side, and they tried to take Constantinople from the Turks and kick Turkey out of the war. And they tried it in Gallipoli, and it was a disaster. But when Allenby went into the Holy Land, he came up from Egypt, through Sinai, to Beersheba, and then up and took Jerusalem. They drove the Turk out. And Revelation 16, verse 12, speaks of the drying up of the great river Euphrates, that is the opening of the sixth vial. And this was accomplished by Allenby. And his name is a curious name, actually. Some of you may well know this, that there was a proverb of the Arabs called Allah, the prophet of the Lord will bring water from the Nile, and then Jerusalem will be liberated. And in Arabic, a prophet of the Lord is Allah Nebai. Allah Nebai. So here was Allenby, the prophet of the Lord, as it were, who liberated Jerusalem, fulfilling the Arab proverb. I'm sorry about that, but that is a little point of history. Right, so they're going to have to fight, and God will punish the goat nations there, chapter 10, verse 3, and chapter 12, and verse 2 and 3, "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all people round about when they shall be in the siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem. In that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all people of the earth be gathered together against it." And verse 9, "It shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplications, and they shall look upon me whom they have feared. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn." So they will look upon him whom they have feared. So here are the Jews brought to a point under these devastations and desolations where they acknowledge their Messiah who shows them his wounds and that they pierced him with. And this will be a moment of great awakening to the Jews in the land. And we know that thenceforth, when they have conquered the city, Christ and the saints, they will issue forth the Aeonian gospel proclamation, calling upon the nation to submit or perish. To submit to Christ's authority or perish. This will be the choice that will be given to the nation. And coming to that chapter we read by way of introduction, two-thirds of Israel will perish. Verse 8. Two parts are going to be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. So it is this third that Christ works with. They are his bow, and Ephraim the diaspora his arrow. This third of the Jews that's left. Now, if there's 6 million Jews in the land, which is believed to be the case, that means 4 million perish when Russia sweeps down in Ezekiel 38. 4 million. And they will fight as they fought never before. They'll fight for their existence. People are already saying about Iraq that it faces an existential threat. An existential threat. This is the Prime Minister of Iraq from the Islamic Caliphate. But this is nothing to what is coming. This is just a little foretaste of the troubles that are going to engulf all nations, with the epicentre in Jerusalem. Now, we could go back to Jeremiah chapter 12, and we start to conclude our remarks here. You're probably ready for me to conclude that. But in case you're not, we'll consider a few more scriptures. Jeremiah 12, verse 10. Now this is really harking back to Deuteronomy 28. "Many pastors have destroyed my vineyard. They have trodden my portion underfoot. Now you think about that verse, for they have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness." These many pastors that Jeremiah prophesied will downtread his people and the city of Jerusalem. Who are these many pastors? Now Daniel gives us the answer to that. They downtread Jerusalem. If you keep your finger down, turn to Luke 21 and link these two verses, and that one is worth putting alongside the other. Verse 24, "They shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles." Notice that. Trodden down. Now what does Jeremiah say in verse 10 of Jeremiah 12? "They have trodden my portion underfoot." So they will be trodden down. And the Jews have been persecuted ever since they were driven out by the Romans. There have been pogroms against them. The Catholic Church regarded them as heretics. They were driven out of Spain in 1492 by Ferdinand and Isabel. There was no way for them to flee from the scourge of papal Rome. In this country, when Richard I came back to this country from the First Crusade, He launched pogroms against all the Jews. Hundreds were killed in York, in what is known as Clifford's Castle, Clifford's Tower. They perished. They took their own life, like they did at Masada, rather than surrender to the papists. So, bearing in mind these many pastors, we think of Daniel chapter 2. Here are the Jews being led away by Rome. That's on the Arch of Titus in Rome, with the menorah, the seven-branched lampstand. And it was actually ploughed underfoot by the Romans and renamed Aola Capitolina. And that is, you'll find in Micah chapter 3, that Micah said it would be ploughed over as a field. Micah chapter 3. Therefore shall Zion for your sake be ploughed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps. Who become heaps? And the mountain of the house of the high places of the forest. So the last revolt against the Romans was that of Bar Kochba in AD 135. Many people think it was Masada, but it was actually Bar Kochba in the reign of Hadrian. And Hadrian defeated the revolt against the Romans by Bar Kochba. And as a consequence of that, he had Jerusalem obliterated altogether from being a city. And it was ploughed over as a field in the time of Hadrian. And of course it did spring up again. But he renamed that city Aola Capitolina. So, to finish up our remarks, we'd like to go to Daniel chapter 2, which is this great Goliath colossus that will be slain on the mountains of Israel by the multitudinous Christ. We see this great image. I've got a picture of it here. You've all seen this before in my talk. Here's a picture of the Russia controlling Europe through its pipelines. Most of them go through Ukraine. This is why Ukraine is so important to the Russians, because the pipelines go through that area. Here we are. Here's the Ukraine. They come down to Italy and the Balkans, and they go right across to Germany and France and to the Eastern Europe, all through the Ukraine. So here we have the image, a vision of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 2. Head of gold, chest and arms of silver, thighs of belly and thighs of brass, two legs of iron, and the feet part of iron and part of clay. Then this great stone smashes the image. Now, it's all confederate. We have here depicted symbolically Babylon, Persia, Greece and Rome, and the two legs of Rome established by Constantine, the East and Western Roman Empire. So when this stone smashes it, it is all confederate. So that we expect to see Russia as the great power of the last days confederate all these territories. And that will include Mesopotamia, it will include Persia, Iran, it will include Greece and most of Europe. And it will include Libya and Ethiopia in this mightiest manifestation of sin at the time of the end, which will be broken upon the mountains of Israel. Verse 28. This is a vision of what shall be in the last or latter days. So this is not so much an outline of history. And we think, well, what is this vision showing us, really? It is showing us the powers that would downtread the Jews and downtread Jerusalem and downtread the Holy Land. So this was an array of powers, and a sequence made people look at history, and they're totally confused by it. But the scriptures show us a pattern. And it's by that pattern that we can see the hand of God. That there's a definite sequence of powers. Babylon, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. And then the time of the end, when this stone power will smite the image. And we read there in verse 44 and 45, this confederate, the 2 feet, the confederate part of the iron and the clay, the iron of old Rome and the clay power of Russia, will unite and cause the image to stand up on the mountains of Israel. And so those of those kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all those kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So here is an everlasting kingdom which shall never be destroyed. All other kingdoms manage God every form of government, republics and democracies and all kinds of government, but they've all collapsed. But this one will never collapse, because it is founded on righteousness. And it will last forever. It will last for the hidden period, the 1,000 years of Christ. When we go back to 2 Samuel 7, we see those promises that were made to David concerning an everlasting kingdom, an everlasting throne, and an everlasting temple. That is on the face of it. 2 Samuel 7. They shall build, I will establish his kingdom. I will raise up the seed out of thy bowels, verse 12, when thou art asleep. So this could not be Solomon, because this king is raised up after David had deceased, whereas Solomon ascended the throne before David had deceased. So it could not apply to Solomon. It must apply to David's greater son, and that greater than Solomon. I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house in my name. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now that word ever is the Hebrew word olam, the hidden period. And sometimes it's forevermore, as in Psalm 132, ad olam, the hidden period and beyond. So Christ will rule, this righteous king, who will establish a kingdom and a throne and their temple forever, for the olam, for the hidden period of 1,000 years. Verse 16, and thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee, or for the olam. Thy throne shall be established for the olam. So we've got three things here. We've got the kingdom, we've got the temple, or the house, and we've got the throne. And David is being promised that God would establish unto him, our his greatest son, David the Second, a throne, an everlasting throne that would last for 1,000 years, and it would go beyond into the beyond period, beyond the 1,000 years, which Paul called the third heaven, and which was so glorious he could not speak of those things. He could not utter the things he had seen, had been privileged to see concerning that epoch beyond. So this, and yet this olam, this hidden period, will be a beautiful period when God will establish peace and righteousness and justice throughout the earth. And he will purge the earth of all its abominations, all its filthiness, all its wickedness. And you go through to the New Jerusalem in the Apocalypse. And I think we'll finish upon this note. I could go on for much longer, but I fear I'm testing your patience and attention. So we better draw remarks to a close with the vision of the New Jerusalem. In Revelation 21, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. Now this must be the beyond period, because there's no more sea. It's not the literal sea of something, it is the sea of nations. Although I make a full end of thee,
says the Yahweh to the prophet Jeremiah, of all nations, I will not make a full end of thee. Although I make a full end of all nations, I will not make a full end of thee. So, in the time of Jacob's trouble, the time of tribulation, God will preserve the Jews from annihilation and destruction. We know that the city will be taken, Zechariah 14. Half the city taken into captivity, the women ravaged. A terrible time for the Jews, 4 million dead. They're on the point of political extinction when Christ manifests himself. And we see here, therefore, at the end of the 1,000 years, there will be no more Sea of Nations, but there will still be Israel. Although I make a full end of all nations, I will not make a full end of thee, but I shall punish thee in measure. And I, John, so that is a glimpse of the beyond period, that new heavens and earth there. I, John, saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. So here you have the new Jerusalem. It is a city, as Ezekiel sees in Ezekiel 40, a four square city, a mile in every direction. It's the temple, it is the city, it is Zion. They're all one and the same thing. It is the house of Yahweh, a house of prayer for all nations. Think of the amount of stones required to build that. It will take 40 years to build. This third temple, Solomon was the first, Ezra and Nehemiah was the second, greatly enlarged by Herod, and this is the third temple. There's a picture of Herod's temple, a glorious building which, as I say, Titus wanted to save, but one of the Roman soldiers, when they burst in, knocked over the lampstand and set it on fire. And so they literally tore the stones apart to get at the gold that was running down amongst the stones. And so, as Christ prophesied in the Olivet Prophecy, not one stone should be left standing upon another. And yet, even at that point, the disciples were thinking what a marvellous building it is. They couldn't comprehend that it was going to be destroyed. And yet, as far as God was concerned, that temple, they've made it a den of thieves. It was apostate. And he was going to destroy it. 40 years later, he did, with the Roman armies. So we have this new Jerusalem. Jerusalem is not only a city, it's a people. We have it compared to the bride. We have it likened to the bride. It is the bride. The new Jerusalem is the bride. So it's the bride of Christ. Who are these? That symbolic 144,000. A numberless multitude that we see in Revelation 7. Who are these? These are they who have come through great tribulation, who have washed their garments in the blood of the Lamb and made them white as snow. They've come through great tribulation. They haven't been trying to find an easy path. They've stood for the truth. They've defended the truth. They've contended earnestly for the faith. And therefore they've suffered. They haven't been entangled with this world and all its opportunities. They have repudiated this world. They have repudiated sin. This world doesn't recognise sin anymore, if it ever did. But now it's cast the Bible away, and secularism and humanism prevail like a thick black darkness across the earth. Isaiah 60, isn't it? Gross darkness covereth the earth. When Christ comes, gross darkness to people. So here we have that new Jerusalem. And we have there the foundation referred to it in verse 14. The wall of the city had 12 foundations. In them the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So the foundations of this new Jerusalem are the 12 apostles. And then a bit later on we find that these foundation stones are encrusted with jewels. They are adorned or garnished with jewels, verse 19. The foundation of the wall of the city was garnished with all manner of precious stones. And they're listed, the 12 precious stones there, which correspond with the, in some way, with the breastplate of the high priest of Israel, Aaron, the high priest. So you have a picture of these 12 foundation stones on the wall forming the New Jerusalem. It's a perfect cube. So it speaks of a perfected order of priests and kings who will reign over the earth. They will be the bride of Christ. And this picture of the foundations of the apostles, they have kept the faith of the apostles. This is what they've striven to preserve. Raised up, as you know, by Dr. Thomas, the ancient faith of the apostles. This is what they cherish. This is what they guard. This is what they defend unto the death. And therefore they are the jewels garnishing these 12 foundations of the apostles. Because they're precious in God's sight. Because they've suffered through much heat and pressure, as precious stones do, and they've had to be cut and polished. So now, when they are adorned with immortality and divine nature, they are holy, pure, and divine in their very nature, as well as in their character. Now they're trying to develop a character, holy, pure, and divine. Then, when they are changed into that glorious nature, they will be holy, pure, and divine in their very substance, consubstantial with God Himself, whose purpose is to raise up His own family, to call out a people for His name, who shall be a multitude of mighty ones, expressed in the phrase Yahweh Elohim, He who will be mighty one. That combination which we see so often in the Old Testament is always prophetic of God's plan and purpose, to manifest Himself in a multitude of mighty ones who are worthy to be given that divine nature. And you think about it, brethren and sisters and young people and respected friends, to be given immortality, to live forever, to give the divine nature. Well, this has to cost us something, because God is only going to confer that upon those who are worthy of it. They won't hand that around whole scale. So there you have that beautiful picture of the New Jerusalem. And verse 25, the gates of it shall not be shut at all, day nor night. So the temple in the future age will be open continuously. You know, we've just read in the readings how that the priests, they praised God all through the night. The temple was open in that sense, not to worship. There were those porters that opened the gates of the temple, the precincts of the temple, each morning, new every morning. But the praises and thanksgiving to God through the Psalms was sang all through the night. And you read of that in First Chronicles about the priesthood. Well, here the gates of the temple will never be shut. But coming on to chapter 22, well, before we get there, verse 26, they shall bring the glory and honour of the nations unto it, and there shall be no wise enter into anything that defileth, neither whatsoever worketh abomination and maketh a lie, but they which are written in the Lamb's book of life, so that nothing that defiles or pollutes mentally, morally, spiritually will be allowed into that temple and into that divine nature. Nothing that defiles or pollutes the holy name of Yahweh. For this is His purpose, to establish His name in Mount Zion, to reign with His angels gloriously. Isaiah 24. These constitute His name. These who are worthy, who have fought the good fight and warred the warfare. So that all without, we read in verse 15 of the next chapter, for without are dogs and sorcerers and whoremongers and murderers and idolaters, whosoever loveth and maketh a lie. So these are without, and all these will be destroyed in the judgments of God, which will last 40 years after the taking of Jerusalem, until the earth is purged of all those categories of people there. Without are dogs and sorcerers and whoremongers and murderers and idolaters. So, briefly, we've reviewed the history of Jerusalem. brothers and sisters, respected friends, and young people. And there's much more detail. The Bible, of course, is full of thousands of references to Jerusalem. And we know how David, really, the history of Jerusalem began with Melchizedek, then 1,000 years later with David, when he took the city, when Joab climbed the gutter and took the city from the Jebusites. And that history has continued ever since, but mainly in that downtrodden state and the land becoming desolate. There's a picture of that tunnel which from Mount Spring of Gihon went up into Jerusalem, which Joab scoped to take the city from the Jebusites and establish the temple and the tabernacle of David there. And so there's been holy war for Jerusalem, holy war which is grounding to a grand climax right now. As Russia is about to annex the whole of Europe, she has 155,000 troops on the borders of Ukraine. She has 4,000 tanks and 623 planes and bombers ready to take the whole of Europe. And there's only one thing restraining her, and that is Yahweh, the God of Israel, because he controls events. And when he is ready, he will cause Putin to release those massive forces upon Europe, to annex the whole of Europe, to rebuild the empire of Justinian and Constantine, and then sweep down into Turkey to plant the Greek cross on the Hagia Sophia, and then sweep down, Daniel 11 verse 40, he shall push against him and overflow and pass over and come down, and Edom and Moab and Ammon will escape. They will be under the control of the Tarshish power, where Jordan is today, and he will push them back across the Jordan. They will bravely try to defend Israel, but they will be pushed back, and Russia will come right down into Egypt with many ships. Now, I meant to bring an article, some of you might have seen it, that Russia plans to build a new naval base in the Black Sea and to build 207 warships by 2020, that is within the next 6 years. A huge navy. She's already captured the Ukrainian navy. She's got Sevastopol. She's going to build all these warships. She's spending nearly 360 billion pounds sterling on revamping and upgrading and updating her military force. So, when the right moment arrives, God will unleash this upon the world. No doubt China will be with Russia when World War III, or the Battle of Armageddon, unfolds. That's what we read of earlier on in the Apocalypse. Revelation 16, the Battle of Armageddon, the final war to end all wars, the final conflict over the city of Jerusalem, the holy war for the city of Jerusalem. It will be fought over by the Jews, by the Russians, by the Tarshish powers, but Judah's lion will defeat them all. And so he gathers them together into a place called the Hebrew tongue Armageddon, a heap of sheaves in a valley for judgment. And we notice in that prior verse, we have the dragon and the beast and the false prophet, verse 13. And you have these three unclean like frog spirits of revolution coming forth out of the dragon and the beast and the false prophet and going forth to the whole earth. And we see these frog-like revolutionary spirits now gripping the Islamic fundamentalists, the Arab states, the Arab nations in the ISIS caliphate and the Hamas, the Hezbollah. And they keep mutating like this Ebola. This new strain is being mutated all the time, so they can't combat it, and it's spreading. There will be over 1 million victims by the end of the year, over 1 million. This is what they're predicting now. It's already sprung up in America, in Dallas, in Texas. So this is the beginning of a global pandemic, but just like this deadly affliction, this deadly plague, this malignant ulcer which is spreading out from the Middle East, So it's like Ebola, and it keeps morphing into new forms. We've got Boko Haram, we've got Khorasan, we've got ISIS, we've got Hamas, we've got Hezbollah, and they keep morphing into different forms and mutations as these plagues of locusts come up out of the pit of the abyss to cause the final conflict over Jerusalem. And of course we have that beautiful picture, we've seen it in Psalm 48 and in Isaiah chapter 2, when all nations will flow up to the city of Jerusalem. We'll finish upon that note. I know I've referred to this chapter before, but it's such a beautiful vision that I'm sure you won't mind if I refer to it again. And of course we've got Jeremiah 3. There's many, many chapters, and those who've seen in Zechariah, the Feast of Tabernacles, which will be established, all nations shall come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Zechariah chapter 14, those that are left from the judgment. And when you think, Jeremiah says the slain of the Lord shall be from one end of the earth unto the other. There's not going to be many left. They start talking about the population now exploding as they've never seen it before. They've underestimated it. It's 7 billion going on 8 billion. Within a few years, it could be 12 billion. And the earth cannot possibly cope with this number of people on this planet, devouring, consuming, and plundering the resources of the earth. You know, you've got containers now, bulk ore carriers coming from Brazil, which can carry, one bulk ore carrier, 400,000 tons of iron ore. This is the way man is plundering the earth for its coal and its iron, its precious metals. and of course, no doubt some of you heard the report that half the wildlife in the earth has been destroyed in the past 40 years. Half the wildlife upon the earth, 50%, has been destroyed by man. God will destroy those that destroy the earth. And so the final picture there of Jerusalem in Isaiah chapter 2. It shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established in the top of the mountain, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And my people shall say, Come ye, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his path. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, or the Torah, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. And so he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning. And nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. So here is that final picture of Jerusalem, with all nations flowing up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. There shall be no more war. He that is the Prince of Peace will have tranquilized and subdued the nations under his iron rod. He shall rule them with a rod of iron and dash his enemies to pieces like a potter's vessel. Psalm 2 you know so well. And so they can teach as much as they like about Neanderthals at school, as we heard someone telling us about their children at school being taught history lessons starting with Neanderthals. Michael Gates is saying they should start with the Big Bang. This is the depth of intoxication and darkness. They have no comprehension that God has a plan and a purpose, and he aims to fulfill it, and has given assurance unto all men in that he has raised his son from the dead, and that he will judge the earth in righteousness. And this is the day we're looking for and longing for, brethren and sisters, and cry out, How long, O Lord, how long? We know it is imminent. Thank you.